downloading this episode of Snacks for the Brain. We're truly grateful for your interest in what we're doing to bring the joy of research and discovery to K-12 students and teachers the whole world over. Bi-weekly or so, we'll share some fun, independent, pod-safe music. We'll interview some working research scientists, students, or leading proponents of educational change, and we'll toss in an educational sound-seeing tour or computer tip.
Can't miss it for you. We'll be right here.
At blogs.vanderbilt.edu/S4TheB and at the CSO website at scienceoutreach.org, sharing good brain munchies with you. So listen up. Let's get right down to it with episode number
79
of Snacks for the Brain.
Hello, y'all, and yes, we are looking at episode number 79 of Snacks for the Brain. I'm lacing this podcast with some really nice acoustic and electric guitar music from Oregonian David Modica, purchased at one of my favorite sources for music, Magnatune.com. You can name your own price for music there. Did you know that? Think of it as Priceline for tunes. The listen today, in addition to the fabulous guitar grooves, is the second half of sophomore presentations from the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach's Vanderbilt School for Science and Math, a thriving boon to the Metro Nashville Public School System's learning resources that brings 25 high school students at each grade level to the Vanderbilt University campus one day a week for hands-on, research-grounded, lab-based schooling. You can learn more about the School for Science and Math at its website, theschool.vanderbilt.edu. By the way, in episode 80, I promise we'll have a tech tip tidbit. Due to some longer content lately, I've neglected to add those into the mix, an omission I plan to remedy next show when Snacks for the Brain turns octogenarian. Let's get right into this. I need to hear more David Modica. I'll lead into the presentations with Modica's By Your Side, then afterwards, I'll serve up its haunting version of Scarborough Fair. If you don't leave with a smile on your face, I'll refund your money. Just kidding.
gave this presentation, Function, Function, because it's all about the function of the brain.
My first question was how memories are stored and retrieved. Now, we know that information is stored in the neurons, and we know that we have billions of these neurons. Now, even though they're spread throughout the body, we know that in the medial temporal lobe, there's the hippocampus, which we know can produce new neurons, even while you're an adult, which was previously believed that you can never produce new neurons. And it's believed that these neurons control this information. Now, on November 5th, we had a presentation by Willie Hoener about cellular communications. They talk about how cells use hormones to send information between one cell to another. We think that these neurons are used as routes or paths so that the hormones can be sent from one cell to another in order to relay this information.
And our second question is kind of related to the first question, and why do we dream? And it's believed that when we learn something and when we dream, it's kind of the effect or to see if we learned and to relate what we learned. And if we have a different experience, with our dream will have a difference and you will have a different event. And we dream. The dream happened in the right eye movement. And it detects that they have experiment throughout using MRI to see how the brain functions and how they move when the person is experiencing different type of feelings, emotions, and sometimes food can affect them by dreaming nightmare or strange things, and you require energy to do it. So it's kind of like the food that you eat, so it functions, still functioning while you sleep.
This is the last slide. Okay. Our next question is, does the brain communicate or receive signals other than those that it generates itself? So like psychics or like something abnormal like psychics or people that can talk telepathically or maybe quote unquote read other people's minds. I mean, what causes them to do that? What kind of enrichment in the neurons causes that? And then a positive method for going about answering this question would be to use machines to detect all sorts of signals that are being emitted from the body. So if you're dreaming about something, you know, like repeating in your head, like dog, dog, dog. I mean, what kind of emotions would you have? Like, if your dog just died, and you would be sad about it. So that would be like one different emotion. Then another person's like, oh, I love my dog, I'm so happy. So yeah, it'd be a different emotion there.
Well, I said,
yeah, you are.
Okay. This is our group. If you don't know us, then hello.
Okay.
Our first question was, how did life arise on Earth and where? And if y'all remember that one morning, we each went into five or six different groups, and we each had a different theory about how the different theory about how life on Earth arose, and those were, oh, that's not the right slide. Okay.
Go. Well, this is a big question because knowing how we got life on Earth can help us find life on Mars or how there could have been life on Mars or other planets, not just Mars. It helps. It's really just because we're curious. It's not really, other than the Mars thing, like it's not really helpful in any way except that we want to know. So
we basically always wanted to know where we've come from. That's why myths and legends. My next slide. Okay, so this is what I was talking about earlier. So the difference of the different theories was life from ice and the eutectic freezing came from that. Brittany, want to expand on it? Okay. You can't remember that, I'm sorry. Go look it up. Life from These Seasons, and the ironic thing was, these two came from the same scientists, Stephen something. And then Life from Meteors, was that DeAndre's group? Did DeAndre have them? Where is DeAndre? Did you have that?
No.
It was you? Okay, sorry. Okay, so that group had it. You can consult with them. And basically it said we're all actually aliens. Is that semi-true? Yes, and that's what it said. Okay, and then life actually arose from RNA, not DNA. And that kind of goes back to the life from ice, that RNA reproduce or works really well under really, really cold conditions. Okay.
So there's really no definite way to prove any of these. You can find which ones are most likely by studying, by recreating the conditions of early Earth at the time life would have begun, like, happening, I guess. And then we could see, like, how efficient these processes would be, like, how well life would form in ice or deep sea vents or meteors or anything like that, just to see which one is most likely.
Could any of the feasible processes that led to life on Earth could or have occurred or be occurring on Mars? That is obviously, like we said earlier, that's one of the questions that relates to this question. Is that a connection that we can make? And also, are the conditions on Mars similar enough to early Earth to allow, like, similar processes to occur? And we could find this by, recreating the conditions of early Earth or the conditions on Mars and comparing them.
And then our other question that wasn't one of the top 25, but we liked it, was what is a species exactly? And so, like a lot of y'all said, we've been talking about species and how, you know, we're still... What defines a species really blurry? Like, we know Homo sapiens aren't the same as the plants for studying, but what is it? And so that's the problem, because the current method, like I just said, it doesn't really clearly define what a species is. And this could help us classify and organize organisms more, and this could lead to, this is good for helpful for taxonomic purposes as well.
So some of the things we've talked about, like the ring species of salamanders, where they were in a circle and they could mate with the ones next to each other, but across the circle they were completely different. So is that all one species or several smaller ones? And I think last year we talked about, like, barcoding species. Was it last year?
Yeah. Okay, if y'all remember, we had to read an article, like, first semester last year. It had a zebra on it, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we all remember it. So it's just that we would, like, make a barcode for every species. And, like, then when we made the periodic table, how there were gaps in between it. And so we would be like, well, that means this element must exist, but we just can't find out. We haven't found it yet. It'd be kind of the same thing with the barcoding life, that you would see there's a gap and you could hopefully find it and know what to search for. So that's that.
So some of the ways we could address this question, we could start by sequencing the genomes of many different species like we did with our plants, which would help us to compare them across their genomes and see where they're similar. And so then if we had a more concrete definition of a species that was based more on genetics maybe than behavior or appearance or things like that, then we could just do it by the genetics of it. Like, these are however percentage similar.
And the life with planets is, I think we all know how they recently, a year or two ago, they redefined, or they made the definition of planet more concrete, because they couldn't decide whether, for a long time, whether Pluto was a planet or not. And part of the reason was because, well, if Pluto was a planet, that meant there are other, like, 40 or 50 or some ridiculous number of other really small or large rocks, basically, that would be considered a planet. So they defined it more precisely. So now Pluto's. But they created a more concrete definition, which is what we need to do with species. Next question.
Like Rachel was saying with the periodic table earlier, they found the pattern, and therefore the gaps in the pattern, they could predict easier what could fill those gaps or what was in those gaps. And like with the organisms, if we have a clear definition of species, we can look at the species that we already have and fill in the gaps with what could evolve or what has died out in the past, and we could predict what fills those gaps in. Yeah, we can fill those gaps easier. And by analyzing the relationships between present organisms, could we predict evolutionary patterns and future relationships, like some symbiotic relationships and things like that? And basically, if we could become awesome statisticians, then that would be pretty cool.
How much can the human lifespan be extended? Was our first question in the top 25.
We've extended the lifespan of other organisms, sometimes by keeping them on a low-calorie, high-nutrient diet, and sometimes by reducing the activity of insulin-like growth factor 1. But we're not sure if that's going to work with us. They're having clinical trials to see if that does, but right now we don't know, so we're just trying to figure it out.
So this semester we have theorized about expanding life when we had that big debate, and it was kind of one decided debate. Nobody else seemed to want to live forever. But we were saying you could do that by like curing cancer and other diseases and that kind of thing. We read an article for one of our weekly challenges, the genetics of dogs. It mentioned the role of IGF-1 in body, referring to the body size of humans and mice. And we talked about how when genes get older, I think Dr. Yu touched on this, their millimeters bring off. And so they just kind of like get old and gray and don't keep producing more.
So the next question might be, how can we improve the quality of life instead of just trying to extend life? And many scientists have actually decided to go ahead and research this question instead of just improving the lifespan, because there's really no use trying to live forever if you're just going to feel really bad the whole time and you've got like this horrible disease that you have to live with.
Or always trying to get transplants. Or to improve the quality of life, we could work on preserving the environment more. Just so, who wants to live in a world crowded with people and there's just concrete everywhere? I mean, that's, you're not going to be happy. I mean, everybody seems to be in a better mood with this classroom because we have light outside our window inside the building. And you can look out and be like, oh, there's green. And so, and we can also research various health disorders such as HIV, cancer, or allergies, because who wants to live forever with asthma or with they're allergic, they have hay fever, so they have to take medicine every spring. And we can also improve our diets by adding more nutrition and increasing exercise, because you don't want to live forever all like a couch potato or something.
Our next question was, will Malthus continue to be wrong? Which is interesting because nobody else picked it, but I was really interested, so yeah. Okay, so first of all, what was Malthus' theory? Who was he? So he was this scientist
to, in his famous essay, the essay on the principle of population. He wrote that the human population will always tend to grow, and eventually they will always be checked, either by foresight, such as birth control, or as a result of famine, war, or disease, which basically says that we will be checked sometime, either we could try with, medicines and all this stuff to stop it, but we will be checked throughout the 20s. Famine, what's going on right now, in Africa and some parts of India and stuff, you have famine, which is kind of a check that hasn't gone, and then you have wars, such as World War II, and then you have the Holocaust. The argument, that he had was, it's true in nature. We know that in nature, all organisms have a carrying capacity, which is the number of individuals who can support in a given area with the natural resource limits, and without degrading the natural, social, cultural, economic environment for present or future generations. However, what has happened is carrying capacity is not fixed. Of course, it can move with the improvement of technology, which is what happened with with humans. We're looking for the cure for cancer, and we're doing all this stuff, which, of course, is going to increase our carrying capacity. And here's a graph of the world's population. And basically, I should have put a graph with the carrying capacity, but when it gets there, it reaches the peak, and then it just drops. And basically what Malthus was saying, that we're going to reach the peak and we're going to have to fall sometime. And here is how it is today. We're at 6.5 billion, I think. So this is, in 2005 we were. So we've increased since then. But it just shows you the peak. And so, of course, from the carrying capacity, we know that this has to fall sometime. And so far, he's been wrong. So since the time of Malthus. So he died in 1834, and since then the world's population has risen sixfold and is at more than 6 billion people. And it's been estimated that by 2100 there will be 2 billion people. And it just shows you where our estimations are going and why he's the farther we go along, the more he's been proven wrong, because we haven't gotten to that peak. And here's just some facts to show you, how fast it's growing. In China alone, there are 1,300,000,000 people. And in India, there are 1,100,000,000 people. So, Holly talked about this. This semester, the race, we talked about, the race to find, the race for scientists and stuff, and of course, the race to find a cure for cancer, and with Malthus's goal, and he comes in, and then, of course, who wants to live forever, which goes back to the previous question we had, how far can we push it? And again, if we do, we're just adding more people to it, just because there is not as many people leaving as there's coming in, as bad as that may sound. And then, of course, the Hardy-Weinberg, which had to do with carrying capacity also, because, the mice? We had people die out and stuff. So why is this important? There are so many resources we can use, and there's so much of it out there. So we already have, today we are already at an energy crisis. We're trying to find other alternative ways for fossil fuels and natural gas, and in Africa, the struggle for clean water, and there's a short supply of food, especially a while ago, there was this whole thing with the rice and what else?
Oh, yeah, and then we may not notice it here in the U.S., but once you leave our little circle, the world that we have, you have these conditions get worse and worse. So the next question, how can we control the population without degrading the living condition of the average person? So, you know, we have to control population, but we don't want to, like, you know, stop the cure for cancer totally, because, you know, you're still, then that means you would have to, like, bring the living conditions way down for people, and they couldn't live as, so you have people with all these diseases. And our solution that we came up with is, similar to China, we can put restrictions on the number of children and family they have. We can educate the people about birth control and benefits. So the Chinese one-child policy introduced in 1979 was put in place to alleviate social, economic, and environmental problems in China, which are the same problems that happen when we have an overpopulation. And so authorities claim that the policy has prevented 250 million births from its implication in 2000 in China. So that's still a really significant amount of people compared to what they have now. Yet this policy is also favored with its people, so it's not like, you know, says the Pew Research Center showed that 75% of the Chinese population supported the policy, which shows that
Oh, are you saying that one-child policy was implemented in 2000?
No, it's like...
It was implemented in 1979.
Oh, okay.
But the pool...
Between 1979 and 2000.
Yeah. And so,
There's also BIC, there's Puma Alpha and Puma Beta. They're both the same thing, the only difference is the size. Puma Alpha is a little bit bigger. There's BIM, BOC, BAX, and BIF. And so, based on the results, what do we see? We see a relationship between BIC, BIM, and BAD. Those are three proteins that kill the cell if you have a lot of it. And what we see here was that BIC, we saw that it's dependent on the outside part of EGFR. BIM is dependent on the inside part of EGFR. And BAD does not depend on EGFR at all. It depends on other protein activities, so it doesn't work alone. So you can think of BAD as not just a protein, it's a helper protein. C225, which is the drug treatment, it only affected BIC, and BIC is a protein. If you take a look at these results, and don't forget that green means low activity, so this would be low, nothing, that's a mystery, low, low. So most of them are low, but once you get to BIC, it's red, and red means high protein activity, so it's completely different than what you expect. No one knows why BIC is always comes up different than what you expect in the results. Usually you would expect that they're all low, and this one we have no idea why there isn't anything there. But for BIC, it came up high. So that tells you that BIC is very, very highly sensitive to the treatment, just Cetuximab. Time interval. That's when we use both drugs instantly at the same second, and that's when we put one drug, wait 4 hours with the second drug. We found that most of the proteins, they increased using the 4 hours between the two drugs, that's in weeks 2 and 3. But again, BIC was the only exception, and the results, it increased when I put both drugs at the same second. We found a research that I found, a research that just came out 1 week ago. They found that BIC, there's something strange about BIC. They found these certain types of amino acids inside of it that are not even supposed to exist. Like, they never saw it before what amino acid this is. It's a new amino acid. So now the question is BIC even a protein? If it is, if it's still a protein, it's a special protein. If it's not, maybe it's something that we never knew about the cell before. Future research. I would like to test a wider range of more drug treatments. There's a drug called SARC that came out from Vanderbilt, and we're going to combine SARC and our two other drug treatments that we're using and combine it all together into one mega drug to test. I also want to test more colorectal cancer cell lines. Remember in the beginning I said that there were 6 of them. These two, DIFI and HCT116, they have a lot of EGFR, so that would be really good in our research since our drugs block EGFR, so it would work good with it. Right now I'm currently working with the gene expression change. I'm working with the Human Genome Project with 28,000 genes. My job in the project is to take the results that they have and put it into this database. I have to create 2 databases. It has to characterize every single gene, 28,000 genes, into a graph and We're working on one patient. For example, if I use cetuximab, a drug, after one day, what genes in the entire body, not just the colon, but the entire body, what genes will increase and decrease. And I did one test, and I found that the genes in the brain are the ones that increase the most. So that's strange. You would never think that cancer is involved with the nervous system. So that would be a new research that I'm doing. A future goal, of course, is to treat colorectal cancer in the future, or cure it. And I would like also to thank the members of the audience. Thank you for your time, and thank you for coming to our presentation.
For the brain, we're brought to you by the fine folks at Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out the website at scienceoutreach.org.